This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we're going to be talking poltergeists with Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross. Tom has had a series of poltergeist experiences early in his life, and now more recently as well. Together they wrote a book called The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. It's a very good book, very entertaining to read. And a bunch of stuff that happened recently is not in the book because it happened after the book was published. We're going to be talking about that stuff as well as a very weird experience Tom had about a decade after the initial experiences. So we'll deal with all that tonight. They will be back in a couple of months as there is a second book out as well. This one came out in 2015, available on Amazon and places like that. So also, there were two midweek podcasts this week. The first one, well, I screwed up. And I had a lot of information in there that turned out not to be accurate, and the whole point of it was to clarify information, and I didn't take notes, and that one's on me. I'm going to try and re-edit it and put it back up, so if you saw a podcast that showed up and then suddenly disappeared, that's why. And the second one is up, but for some reason some people, including myself, are having trouble with the download button. It is working now through iTunes. For some reason it didn't post on there. It has been up on YouTube and on the website, but for some reason it never sent it to iTunes. I don't really know what's going on, but I'm working on it, so hopefully I'll have that worked out soon. I also have a Patreon entry from our guest last week that I have yet to get up. Been having some internet issues, which may all be interconnected, not sure yet. But for tonight, this is the story of the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. Enjoy. So I'm talking with Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross, and your first book of a few now was The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, correct?
That's right. My first paranormal book.
Right, yeah. Yes. You are a horror writer,
yeah,
otherwise.
Yeah, that's where I started.
So how did you get into writing paranormal stuff?
Interestingly enough, it only just happened. I mean, I'd always written horror fiction, so I was always kind of interested in that kind of thing. And I always liked horror movies. And then when Tom and I started dating, and I don't remember how long we've been together before he told me about
probably about a year and a half.
But yeah. Before he told me about his poltergeist case. And I didn't really believe it at first because I'm really, really skeptical of pretty much anything paranormal. But the more he talked about it and the more I talked to his family members who had also witnessed it, I kind of got to the point where I was like, you know, maybe there's something to this. And I found the case so interesting and so unlike any other poltergeist cases that I really wanted to write a book about it. So that's kind of how that ended up happening.
And Tom, how old were you when these events happened to you, the initial events anyway?
13, which is about the typical age for it to happen.
Yep. So you want to give people, well, what's your background? Have you been interested in the paranormal your whole life? Or?
Well, I guess it started at 13, so maybe, yeah. Yeah, but I'm very skeptical about 90% of what I hear in the paranormal scene, if that's what you want to call it. There's only a few things that I look for. That's poltergeist is the main one. And a lot of the poltergeist stories I hear, if I base them against what happened to me, I think a lot of them are erroneous. Let's just put it that way. Misidentifications, sure. Possible hoaxes. But there are a few out there that match up exactly with what I saw and what happened to my family. And I, some of them I give my star of approval. Main one would be, what's the one with Janet Hodgson?
Enfield
Poltergeist, yes. In England was very close to what I went through.
Yeah, that's a very interesting case because it was so easily dismissed after the fact. But now that people are bringing out more evidence around it, you're seeing that, yeah, something very significant happened there as far as the poltergeist goes.
Yeah, I mean, it went on for so long and so many people were there.
Police, reporters.
Yeah, so many people were there watching it. It's like, even though the girls were caught faking like one or two times, I think,
yeah.
There's no way they could have faked everything. They got seen. I mean, they were just under too much scrutiny.
Yeah, and doing little faking little incidences here and there is actually kind of common in the, if you kind of consider what situation they were in. It's they were under a lot of pressure to perform, and it's called priming the pump, which is some parapsychologists have known about it. People come in to see something happen, nothing happens. The little girls get under pressure. It's kind of like performance anxiety. They fake something, it's believed, and then that would, but it's something really, really minor that they fake, and it's believed by the observers. So this kind of like gives the girls the psychological confidence to allow the phenomenon to escalate into real phenomena.
Yeah. And they're not consciously doing it anyway. In fact, with the Enfield case, I don't think they ever realized it was coming from them, did they?
No, evidently not.
Yeah, I think she thought it was a spirit, didn't she?
Right. Towards the end, Maurice Gross told her that it was her doing it, and she had a hard time accepting that.
Yeah.
Well, I would think that's hard for most people if they're not familiar with this data, mm-hmm. to understand how they could possibly be doing something like that, especially unconsciously.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably a pretty frightening. I mean, I don't know if it was frightening in your case. It doesn't seem like you were... I think you were more freaked out by the possibility that it was an outside force, and when you realized it was you.
Right. We're kind of getting ahead of the story, I think. But eventually, when I started to suspect myself as being what's called a poltergeist focus, I was apprehensive, but I was also fascinated. And I tried to do it consciously. And, of course, that you can't. But
right. You know. Right. Well, why don't you go through a little bit of the experience for people, how it started and what kind of stuff was happening.
I'll let Jenny set the stage.
And then you can just take over for me.
If you need details, then I'll just... if you have any questions about what something looked like or whatever, I'll tell you. But well, you wrote the book, you know it.
Yeah. Well, pretty much, I mean, basically it was you, your cousin Wesley, who was also 13, your Aunt Lois, and your Uncle Red.
Yeah.
And they were going up to Mammoth Mountain, and they were going to stay in a chateau up there and go skiing for like a week or whatever it was.
And where is Mammoth Mountain?
California.
Okay.
And mountains. And,
Sierra Nevada mountains.
Yeah. And they had never been to this place before. It was just a condo that was owned by an oil company.
Conoco Oil Company.
Yeah, Conoco Oil Company that your mom mm-hmm. worked for. Mm-hmm. So they were staying up there for a week over Christmas. Mm-hmm. And... pretty much, now you told me that you felt dread before you even got there.
Yeah.
Because in the car on the way there, the road looked very much like the beginning of The Shining, you know, when they're driving up to the Overlook.
Yeah,
and all the snowy mountains and like this lonely road, like going up in the hills and everything like that. So you kind of were freaking out before you even, not freaking out, but...
I was weird.
Apprehensive.
Yeah, it was kind of a spooky trip up there, and you know, all of a sudden the hood to the Jeep flew up. It flew up while we were on a mountain road, and my uncle was able to stop the car, and he went out and checked the hood and slammed it, and came back in, and we said, "What happened?" And he goes, "I don't know. I can't find any problem. Everything seems to be normal. It just flew up." So we completed the drive and ended up getting there probably about a half hour to an hour later. Mm-hmm. And it was just a normal looking, kind of like a condominium. I included photos of the condominium complex in the book. And you can see there's nothing really special about it. And we walked in, and as soon as we walked in, our reaction was just kind of like, ooh. It was, as we crossed the threshold, it was almost kind of like you were entering into like another zone, like a high pressure zone or something. It felt cold in there, kind of like you just walked through a membrane. But, you know, it was winter time, and the heat wasn't on in there, I don't think. So it was kind of hard to, you know, really put your finger on it. But I remember feeling like I was being scrutinized or watched as soon as I walked into that house. And as I went down to the hallway, we were choosing rooms to stay in, and I chose the very first room on the right, near the, as you walked into the front door. And I had a little carry-on bag, and I set it down on the bed and walked back out to the car to go get my suitcase. And as I walked back into the room, I'd only been gone for a few seconds, I noticed some motion out of the corner of my eye, and I saw a rolled up pair of socks just going across the bed fast and come to a screeching halt about 4 feet away, three or four feet away from the bag that I had set down earlier. And that bag was on its side and opened, and some stuff was strewn out of it. I saw that, and I was just like, man, I don't remember opening that bag. Did it just fall over? What was that? So I just kind of shook it off and said, you know, that's just my imagination playing tricks on me. So I just unpacked, and day went on normally. I guess the next thing that happened is we all went off to the ski slopes. And my uncle and I weren't skiers, but my aunt was skiing, and we got bored, my uncle and I, and we just started driving around. And I asked my uncle, I asked him, I said, you believe in haunted houses? And he's like, well, when we used to practice, do band practice in a little house, and it was kind of creepy, but I think it was just rats. Why are you asking me this? And I said, I think the house is kind of creepy. And he's like, yeah, it is creepy. And I said, you think that house is haunted? And he goes, I don't know. Let's go check it out. So we went back to the house. And when we got there, there were all these little hand towels in strange places that weren't there before. Little folded up little washcloths. Two of them at the foot of each bed, just gently folded over in one-thirds, side by side. And they're just kind of at the foot of hanging off the side of the bed. And one of them was in a room at the very end of the hallway, wrapped over the, what do you call it, the backrest of a chair that was used for a drafting table. And my uncle's sitting there, we're looking at this hand towel folded over on the back of that drafting table. And my uncle's like, where are these things coming from? Is this room service or something? And I said, I don't know. And I saw my uncle grab the back of that chair and push it into that table. Wait a minute. Did I miss the part?
What part?
I missed the first. That was on the second day.
Yeah.
See, that's what I got you here for. To keep me. That was the second day.
That's right.
Missed the part what happened that night.
That's right.
Yeah. Maybe I should back up.
Okay.
Maybe I should back up. Okay. That was the second morning that all that happened. The first night that we were there, after I saw the rolled up pair of socks, I was going to sleep in that room, and I heard the coat hangers jingling in the closet in the room that I was in. And it sounded like they were moving in a gentle breeze. And I was kind of petrified, you know, when you're 13 years old, you're like, what's in the closet, you know? How is there a breeze in the closet? Right. And as I was freaking out over that, I heard something drag itself across the carpet at the foot of the bed. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't kind of have the nuts to just jump up and look. But I could hear it. It sounded like it moved about 4 feet. It sounded like it weighed probably about 50 pounds. And it sounded like it was maybe 2 foot square. And I heard it drag across that carpet. And then it just kind of faded away. And then the telephone on my right on that nightstand, I heard it lift up off the receiver and drop. You know those old telephones from the 80s had the push buttons?
Yep.
And that freaked me out. So that happened the night before. And that's why I was asking my uncle why, you know, asking him if he thought the place was haunted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what prompted all that. So anyway, so we find the hand towels. We think it's weird. My uncle pushes in the pushes the chair into the drafting table. We go back to the ski slopes and get my aunt. I told my aunt what we were doing, what we found, and brought her in there, and she was looking at all the hand towels. And when we got to the drafting table, I said, "Red, look at that chair, man. You pushed that in. It's pulled out now." And he says, "I sure did." And my aunt said, "That's weird." And he goes, and she said, "Look at that lamp." There was a lamp at the foot of the bunk bed. She says, "Look at that lamp, because that is an ugly lamp." And it was. I mean, we can't really agree on what it looked like, but it was just an ugly lamp. So we shut the door and walked away from the door, maybe about 6 steps. And my uncle says, "Hold on, let's go back in there and memorize it in case something moves." And I go, "Yeah, that's right." And she opens the door. We'd only been for like 12 steps total. And we look, and I hear my aunt gasp. And I look at what she's looking at, and the lamp is gone. And that lamp that she said was, and it was just left. It was gone, and it only took about 4 seconds, 5 seconds. Well, I screamed, man, and I ran right down that hallway to that front door. And as that front door was coming towards me, I was thinking, "Oh no, man, that door is not going to open. It's going to be just like out of the horror movies. I'm not going to be able to open it." But it opened. And as I was out there hyperventilating, and I went back to the room, and I could see my uncle down on all fours, and he's pulling up on the carpet looking for hidden trap doors in the room. He's turning the place upside down. Who's in this room, you know?
Yeah, because he thought someone was sneaking in there and moving stuff around.
Yeah.
Because you had only been in the room. You had all been, all four of you were looking into the room and saw the lamp.
Right.
Closed the door. 4 seconds, you open the door, the lamp is
gone.
Not there.
Gone. And didn't hear anybody
in
there.
And you didn't hear anything. You didn't.
And there was only one way into that room. One way in or out of that room, and we were covering it. That was that door.
Yeah, you were all standing in the doorway.
There was a window, but that window had been plasticated for winter time.
For the winter, yeah. It didn't.
And that plastication was not disturbed. We checked that. So as soon as that happened, it was on. From that point on, the poltergeist phenomenon really ramped up. It accelerated. And I don't know. You can take over. I'm kind of getting a little bit wound up again.
He's getting wound up again.
Yeah, I'm getting wound up again. I guess what was the next thing that happened? Well, a lot of little things happened, but the next major thing that happened was that I was sleeping up, or I was trying to go to sleep upstairs on that couch.
Because you weren't sleeping in that room.
I wasn't going to sleep in that
room.
After
that first night, he did not sleep in the room downstairs by himself anymore. Actually, nobody slept downstairs after that first night.
Wesley did.
Except your cousin. But
Wesley did. He wasn't really aware of it. He was deaf, you know, deaf and slightly autistic. So he wasn't aware of what was going on until several days into it.
Yeah.
And then it would kind of slip his mind about what was going on. He didn't have a real good attention span, you know.
Yeah, he really didn't seem all that bothered.
He wasn't really all that bothered about it. Although later on, he seemed to be, because he would ask Lois weird questions about that place after he got back. But that's like a side mission.
But it seemed to be affecting his sleeping, wasn't it?
Yeah, it
wasn't
did.
Wasn't sleeping weird?
It did. Yeah, he looked very corpse-like when he was sleeping, and his mother would go in there and check on him. But there was nothing wrong with him, you know. We're not sure whether or not the poltergeist was affecting him, or maybe it might have been some kind of altitude sickness.
Mm. Yeah, could have been one or the other.
It's hard to tell.
I mean, it might have been like you generating that might have like been, I don't know, draining his energy or something.
Yeah, that sounds a little too new-agey.
Like you said, it might have just been.
I think it might have just been altitude sickness.
Because he seemed to sleep a lot and he looked kind of pale.
Lethargic.
And, yeah.
Maybe.
But of course, in the context of all the weird stuff happening, it's not hard to add that into it as something else that's a part of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, having gone through this, I had to re-edit a lot of my suspicions, because as you get older and after you accept what happens, you don't want to read into things too much. You know what I mean? Because if you read into one thing, then all of a sudden you start reading into all these other things and it starts to conflict. You just try to keep it simple. You know what happened, you know what didn't happen. So I try to get rid of suspicions and just stick with things that I know that moved.
And honestly, I mean, when I didn't really get to talk to Wes for the book. He wrote me a letter about what he remembered. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty short and
vague.
And he kind of seems like sometimes he wants to talk about it and sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes he says, that didn't happen, or...
Yeah, or that happened, but it didn't happen. That kind of weird stuff.
Yeah, so that's why I didn't really put a lot of him in there, just because we didn't get a lot of input from him, because he's really kind of vague about his feelings about it.
He didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Now, when Tom initially told you the story, did you believe him?
I believed him, but I wasn't sure that it was... a poltergeist, you know what I mean? Until he kind of described it in more detail, and until I talked to his aunt and uncle, I kind of thought, well, maybe, you know, you guys were just, I don't want to say seeing things, but, you know, maybe you just interpreted things wrong or something like that. But then after we kind of got into it and he, you know, told me more about it, it was almost like, well, that there's no way that that could be. I mean, because it's not like one of those things where it's like, oh, I saw a shadow.
No, it's not vague at all.
It wasn't vague in the least.
Let me tell you the next major thing that happened. When I was trying to get to sleep up on that couch upstairs, my aunt and uncle were in the master bedroom right next to me, and right near them. I was just wandered out of that house, but there was no way to get out because we got hit by a snowstorm and all the roads out of Mammoth Mountain were closed. We didn't know any of the neighbors. A lot of these are like timeshares and things. And we thought people would think that we were crazy if we told them what we were seeing. So we just kind of kept quiet. You know, this was pre-internet. We didn't even know what a poltergeist was. We had never heard of that. You know, this was before that movie came out.
Yeah, this was 1982.
So I was on that couch, and all of a sudden I just heard bam! And a noise. It sounded like the chain to the front door. But it went off like a gunshot, bam, really loud. And my uncle came running out of that bedroom. He said, "What was that?" And I said, "It sounded like the front door chain." And he goes, "I'm going to go down there and check it out." And I said, "All right, man, you go ahead and check that out." And he was a real trooper, my uncle. He went down there without even turning any of the lights on, which I don't know how he could stand it.
Well, he wanted to catch whatever it was. That's what he told me.
He was in denial about it. He thought that maybe there was something physical that he could deal with. There wasn't, though. He walked down those stairs, and he was down there for several minutes. And when he came back up, he says, "I didn't see anything." And I said, you didn't see anything?" He goes, "No, I didn't see anything with a chain, but the bunk bed in that bottom floor has been pushed up against the door. I can't open up the door but about 6 inches. And there was no way to get out of there, you know, after you pushed that big
And the
heavy...
bunk bed was at least 2 or 3
Oh, yeah, pounds. It was made out of logs.
Yeah.
I just went, wow, you know. I finally fell asleep in the creepy house. And when I woke up the next morning, I went directly down to where that front door was because I know it was that door chain. And I noticed that with the lights on, you could see clearly what had happened. The door chain and the mount, you know how the little lock... You know how there's like two different mounts on either side, one on the wall, another one on the door with a chain that goes in between. They had been ripped off and it was hanging by one screw. And where that chain looped over between that door jamb were 3 heavy scratches, probably about 7 inches long each, maybe 8 inches long each. And there were 3 of them like a claw. And I went, "Oh man, that looks just like a claw mark." And that really freaked me out. And I showed it to my uncle. I says, "That's what it was." And he goes, "Oh yeah, it was dark. I couldn't see that. I just thought it was unlocked." Huh. Yeah. And then it went through that whole next day, and stuff was happening. You know, objects were moving. We were starting to catch them move.
And you guys all together couldn't move that bunk bed.
I don't know. It was big around. I would think that maybe me and my uncle could probably move it. But it would have made a lot of noise. It wouldn't have been easy.
Hmm. Yeah, it was really heavy. It was made out of tree trunks.
It was several hundred pounds, maybe 300 pounds, maybe more.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you did occasionally see a blue mist as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was weird. All right. You want to hear the blue mist story?
Well, the first time was when you guys went to get pizza. Right?
Went to go get pizza. Okay. We were getting really tired. We were exhausted and mystified about what was going on. We had been seeing things move by this point. We said, we got to get out of here and get something to eat. So we all piled down into that car down in the parking lot. And the driveway. Driveway was right in front of the chateau. My aunt leans forward and looks up at where would be the living room window on the second floor. And she goes, look at that. Oh, well, shit, I got to back up. When we were leaving, we turned off all the lights and shut the shades. We get into the car and Lois goes, look at that. And I look up to what she's looking at, and the shades were open, and the lights were on. And my uncle went, man, I know I turned that light off. And I said, yeah, you did, and you shut that shade. And Lois is going, man, this is just so weird. And we're all looking at it, and we could see, and my aunt goes, do you see that? And I said, yeah, I think I do. And Ray goes, yeah, that blue haze. And we're like, yeah, yeah, you see it? And you could look up into the window, and up near the ceiling, it looked like the whole ceiling was covered in a blue haze, kind of like, when you look at the sun and look away, it'll leave a spot in your eye, right?
Sure.
Imagine it looked like that, but it was blue, and it was staying still over the ceiling. It was like that. It wouldn't cast light, per se. It wouldn't cast light or make shadows. It wasn't luminescent. It was just a blue field. And if you tried to focus your eye directly on it, it would kind of vanish. But through your peripheral vision, okay, like for instance, if it was up on a ceiling and you tried to focus on a certain spot, you'd see a clear spot in it where you were focusing, but everything else would still be blue. I can't explain it. I can't explain
it. That's strange.
Yeah. Yeah, for some reason, the eye couldn't focus directly on it, but you could see it through slight peripheral vision, and everyone could agree when it was there, when it wasn't there. And it would, just depending on what was going on, sometimes it would be cover a whole ceiling, maybe about 2 feet thick. Sometimes it would cover a whole doorway at the end of let's say, for instance, if you were looking down a hallway into a room, it looked like it would be filling that entire room from a distance. And when you walked up on it, you'd still kind of see it. And it would look kind of like cigarette smoke, but totally even, nothing wispy through it. No particles. It looked like you'd rub your eye or were looking at the sun. It was just, that's the only way I can describe it.
Lois said it looked like indoor weather.
Yeah.
She said, you know that blue cast you get like on a snowy day? She said it looked like that, but inside.
Yeah, and sometimes it was about the size of a, same size and same shape as a beach ball. And it would be up in a corner of a room near the ceiling. And when it was, on a couple occasions when it did that, you had the distinct feeling that you were being watched from that spot. It was weird, man. Really weird.
Okay. Now, this had frightened you a couple of times and then seemed to almost be jovial the next time around.
Oh, yeah. It'd play games. It'd play games with you. Okay. What would be a good game story? The towel?
Yeah, I like
that. Okay. That's a good game story. we were kind of doing our own little investigations, you know, trying to figure out how this thing worked and what it was. It liked to move those hand towels, and it moved hand towels a lot. So I would use a hand towel sometimes to get it its attention. And I took a little washcloth and I folded it in thirds. I took a rocking chair and pushed it up against the window, and I took that towel and folded it over the top of the drapes. And what I was trying to do is I was trying to catch it move something, in the act of moving something.
Mm-hmm.
And my uncle was standing in the doorway watching me do this. And as I came off the chair, I would walk away from that hand towel and real quick look over my shoulder to try to catch it, to see if it had moved. I did this two or three times. My uncle was standing in the doorway, and his eyes were locked on that towel. That was, you know what I mean? He was focusing directly on it.
Right.
Waiting for it to move. Well, I turned back around probably the third time to look at it, and it was gone. So I looked at him and said, where did it go? And I saw him kind of like blink, and he was, I don't know. I was looking right at it. And I said, well, where'd it go? And he goes, I don't know. It's gone. I turned around to walk back towards the drapes to go up there and see if it had fallen behind it or something, you know? And as soon as I turned around, he goes, there they are. And I looked and see what he was pointing at, and he was pointing at my back pocket, and it was folded into my back pocket with half of it hanging out. So I jumped like a scalded dog. Yow! Whoa, whoa, whoa! And I grabbed it and threw it. Grabbed, pulled it out of my pocket and threw it. Like it was hot. And he was like, wow, that was weird. And I said, did you see it go in there? And he goes, no. I was looking at it, and then I couldn't find it. And I said, did you see it wink out or vanish? And he goes, no, not at all. I didn't even see it vanish. I was looking at it, and then all of a sudden, I couldn't find it.
Yeah, that's about the only way he could explain it.
That's the only way he could explain it.
He could find it.
So it didn't really travel the distance from the top of the shades to my pocket. It just
kind of teleported.
It teleported.
And there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
What we didn't say about the lamp before was that when you opened the door and the lamp vanished, later we found it in the closet.
Yeah, found it in the closet.
In the same room, but it almost like it had instantaneously moved across the room.
Now, sometimes we could hear things moving in rooms when the doors were closed. You could hear stuff being shuffled around in there. And when you'd open the door, as you approached the door, the sounds would stop like it knew you were coming. And then you'd open the door and things would be rearranged. So I think some things did travel through the air. But I also think some things teleported. Because some things that ended up in that room had come from rooms downstairs. And we were covering the entrances into those rooms, like standing outside the door when the door shut. So there's no way it could have got in there. Unless it went through, you know, passed through solid matter.
Right, right.
It was just weird, man. And saw the rocking chair. What else? Oh, yeah. But anyway, a lot of stuff happened there over a period of about a week. We ended up leaving, and it followed us. Followed us to my aunt's house. And it did a lot of cool stuff there, too.
At what point did you start to suspect it was connected directly to you?
At my aunt's house. In the final, day and a half.
And what you know, brought that to your attention?
Well, I noticed that I could predict what object would be moved next. Sometimes I'd look at an object like it was calling my attention. Like my eyes would keep falling on something. Like, say, for instance, a vase or something. And I'd look at it, and I could almost kind of see kind of like a clear halo around it, or like a distortion. I knew it wasn't there. It just seemed like there was a distortion around it. And then I'd look away, and then if I looked back, it'd be gone. And I'd freak out, you know. And, you know, people would be in the room with me. And I would told my uncle, I said, I think this thing's reading my mind. And he wasn't really sure that he knew what I was talking about. But I clarified it later, you know, years later, really. And, I thought that maybe it was reading my mind, and then I realized, I said, maybe it's not reading my mind. Maybe I'm doing this somehow. And I said, well, I'm going to test it. I said, I'm going to move that bottle of Jovan Musk into the bathroom. I said, I'm going to make it move it. And it never did. And that was the end of the poltergeist.
Well, because that bottle moved on its own.
It moved on its own first.
It moved from the bathroom into the hallway.
Yeah.
And then, which is what gave you the idea, I'm going to make it move.
I'm going to make it move. I'm going to make it move. And that ended it.
Yeah, it didn't do it again after that. It's almost like you kind of owning the fact that it was you doing it.
Kind of short circuits it somehow.
Yeah.
All right, well, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we're talking tonight with Tom Ross and Jenny Ashford, authors of The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. And where can people get this book?
Amazon is probably the easiest place, and we have it in print and in ebook format.
Okay. And do you have a website or anything?
Yeah, I have a website. It's just jennyashford.com. And I also have a blog at goddessofhellfire.com, and it's got like all my writing news, and I write about horror movies, and I write about poltergeists. I write about all that kind of stuff on there.
Okay, cool. Now, you said that now you have another book out already, and you're working on a third one on poltergeists.
Yeah.
And during the writing of the second one, this poltergeist popped back up.
Yes, it did, oddly enough. And this was
And none of this poltergeist, after that encounter with the him trying to move the bottle, that was the last poltergeist event that happened until the writing of this book.
Pretty much. Well, other than
there was some stuff that happened in the army.
Yeah, but I think that
it was just a related thing. It was related, but not directly. Okay.
Yeah.
So when did this start back up?
It was probably about 6 months after Mammoth Mountain came out, and I was working on my next book, The Rochdale Poltergeist, with Steve Mara, who's a British parapsychologist. So Tom and I were talking about poltergeists. You know, we were doing some radio shows for Mammoth Mountain. We were talking to Steve Mara about his poltergeist case. So, you know, there was poltergeist on the brain pretty much everywhere. And then, strangely enough, it was a Sunday night. I remember that. And two of our friends were over. And your mom was there.
Yeah.
We were all sitting in the living room, and we were trying to get a movie on DirecTV, and it wasn't working.
Mad Max.
We were all going to watch Mad Max because Dimitri and Jen hadn't seen it. And we had already seen it like 6 times at this point. But we wanted to see it again. So we couldn't get the DirecTV to work, and we were getting annoyed, and we were like on the phone with customer service or whatnot. So we're all sitting around the couches. And suddenly the DirecTV remote, which had been sitting in the middle of the coffee table, suddenly flew off the coffee table, flew about 3 feet, landed on the carpet with a thud that sounded like a brick hitting the floor, even though it's just a little plastic crappy, you know, remote control that just clicks and bounces when it falls on the floor normally. But it was almost like it was sucked into the floor, like it was magnetic or something like that. And it took me a second because I had been looking a little bit over it because I think I was looking at your mom. So I looked at our friends who were, you know, at a different angle. And I was like, did you guys just see that? And they're looking at me like with these big eyes. And they're like, yeah, I just saw that. And then I looked over at Tom and I said, did you just do that? And Tom was kind of spaced out, and he's like, yeah, I guess I must have. And then, like, Dimitri was like, cool, do it again. And then it was really weird, and it was really cool because I had never, I mean, from all the talk of the poltergeist case that we've done over the years, I had never seen anything like that in my whole entire life. So I was really, because I kept telling you that I wish I had seen it.
I showed it.
Yeah, now I have seen it. Oh, and the funny thing is that after the remote happened, and we were like kind of farting around trying to replicate it, you know, because I'm like, maybe somebody kicked the table, or maybe, you know, I knew that didn't happen. But and then the
funny
thing,
but you had to go through the motions.
Yeah, we were just like checking, what does it sound like when it falls off the table and all that kind of stuff. And then when you got up, where your foot had been, like where you were sitting on the couch, there was a quarter and a nickel, right?
Yeah, stacked.
On the floor that weren't there before.
Yeah.
And we said the reason that might have turned up is because you said something a day or two before. It's like, why can't the poltergeist bring me anything useful? Like, bring me some money from the bank or something like that.
Yeah.
So it did. It brought you money from the piggy bank in our bedroom.
Yeah.
It just brought two coins and put them right there.
Yeah, and then during that period, that was about a 4 or 5 day period, there was a lot of kind of like ghostly phenomena. Doorbells ringing in the middle of the night, garage doors open, and it smashed some stuff, and it left the back door open.
Yeah, that was pretty weird.
While it was locked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really... Well, I had left for work, and the door was closed.
Yeah.
Because we never opened that door.
And I got up just a few minutes after you got up, and I found the back door wide open with the deadbolt still engaged.
Yeah, it was still sticking way out.
With the cat sitting there staring at it, going, that's not right.
Because that door is never open. We never open. It's the door to the back patio, like from the from the front room.
It's a double door.
Yeah.
And it's not something you use every day. It's just kind of like something if you're going to open up, if you're going to have like a brunch or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think we've only opened it 2 times the whole time we've lived here. But yeah, it was wide open. Because he messaged me at work and he said, why'd you leave the door open? I'm like, why the hell would I? It's like, I never opened that door. What are you talking about?
And then I knew. I said, oh, I know what that was.
Yeah. And then you noticed that the lock thing was sticking out. So it couldn't have opened by itself because the deadbolt was sticking out.
And did you say it also pulled down a shelf or something?
Yeah, you can tell now.
Yeah, this actually, I was at work when this happened, but I got home and I noticed that we have all these like horse statues and they're on top of this shelf on top of the kitchen cabinets, like way up near the ceiling. And a bunch of them were broken, like in pieces on the table. And I said, what happened? And at first, Tom just told me, well, you know, they just fell off and broke. And then the more we were thinking about it, like after the thing happened with the remote.
Yeah.
You said, you know,
it pulled it out by the nails.
It pulled. Yeah. Well, it has like a lip. The shelf has like a lip on it. And the horse statue is like pushed to the back and there's a bunch of them up there.
Yeah.
Only 2 of them came off.
Yeah. And during that time I was mad. I got mad and I heard it go bam. And I ran out there to see what it was. And it had pulled down that thing. I tried to rationalize it at first because there's a little, what do you call it? Air conditioner vent up in that area. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, maybe cold air was blowing on it and it somehow caused it to warp. But man, those nails are 2 inches long.
Well, plus that's been like,
It's been there for years and years and years. Yeah, it
would have blown them down before.
And then the little horse statues that are up there on top of that thing were a good 6 inches from the edge. And the shelf itself can't move. It's solid. It was just
part
of
the top of the cabinet.
So it was the lip was pulled off, and the horses were thrown out because they hit the ground about 5-6 feet from
the cabinet, where
they were. So they had to have a forward trajectory. But that was all small peanuts compared to what happened at when I was 13. If you want the full story, man, you just got to read the book.
Yeah, the book is excellent. I will say that. I enjoyed reading it very much.
Thank you.
The thing, so when you were 13, weren't your parents also going into a divorce right around the time
they
saw that?
They had already been through a divorce.
Oh, they had already been through it. Okay.
Yeah. It was kind of the typical poltergeist-focused background. You have family breakups, poverty, and angst.
Yeah.
But not anything like, you know, bizarre. A lot of people go through that. A lot of people go through that. That's not a big deal. It's just for some reason, in my case, it was. And I can't tell you why. I don't know why.
So when it reappeared, was there anything like stressful going on in your life that would have set it off other than maybe just the writing of the book?
No.
Yeah, that's what was odd about it. I mean, other than the horse statues breaking, where you'd kind of had a fight with your mom, I guess.
Yeah, I was irritated, but I wasn't, you know.
And the same with the remote control. I mean, he was annoyed because the movie wasn't starting, and we had, but, you know, it was just like mild annoyance. It wasn't rage or anything like that.
Yeah. This is just mysterious stuff, man.
I kind of think that it started back again, and I think it significantly started back again in front of 2 of our friends who were really interested in it and who had read
the book. Yeah.
I think subconsciously you wanted them to see it.
I think so too.
And it was almost like you were subconsciously showing off. Like there it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
That's what it was like.
Now, did you say your mom didn't believe it was you until that point?
Well, I don't know if I said that, but that's probably true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was on, you know, unsure. She didn't see it until that point. She had
never seen it.
But her sister did, and her sister told her that it was absolutely true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and then my mom called my aunt and said, I just saw it. It did it. And she goes, yeah, I told you. And my aunt said, you know, don't encourage him is what she said. Don't encourage him because that thing can get violent. Now, my poltergeist never hurt anybody. It never even broke anything. But it sure as hell could throw a knife.
Yeah.
If you've read the book, you know the knife story.
Yeah.
It threw a knife. Want me to go ahead and tell the knife story?
If you want, it's up to you.
All right. This was at my aunt's house.
Yeah, where it followed you after.
Yeah, it followed us already. And I was sitting on the couch. I was kind of wigged out because stuff was happening again. Well, it had been steady happening. I couldn't believe that it followed me at this point. My uncle was sitting on the other couch, and there was a TV in between us up against the wall. And I was just looking down at the floor and near my feet, you know, probably about 10 feet in front of my feet. And right on the side of there was the sliding glass door. I just heard, boom, something hit the ground. And I looked right there near where I was looking, and it was a kitchen knife sitting there. And my uncle gasped. He said, did you see that? And I said, yeah, I saw it hit right there. And he goes, yeah, but I saw it come from the kitchen. And I said,
so this one didn't teleport.
No.
He clearly saw it.
And I said, what happened? And my uncle said, I saw that thing come from behind me, go over the top of my head, a little bit off to the right, go straight to that sliding glass door, do a dead stop in midair, and then get sucked right down into the floor. I just saw it hit the floor, but he saw the hole. And I said, how fast did it move? And he said, it came point forward, perfectly straight, about as fast as you could throw a baseball. And it wasn't going in an arc. It was going in a straight line, like a laser.
Right. So not like it had been thrown. It was like being moved.
Yeah, whatever had it still had a hold of it. And then as soon as it got to the glass, it stopped. It didn't even hit the glass, about an inch from it. So there is it didn't break things. It went out of its way not to break things.
So let's talk about what happened to you in the military when you had an out-of-body experience, because this was fascinating.
Yeah.
So this is, what, 10 years after the poltergeist experience had stopped?
Yeah. Yeah, I was getting close to getting out of the Army. My enlistment was almost done. And I was laying in bed. My roommate was on his side of the room. Because I don't know, you know, a lot of people have never been in the service, but I was in the infantry at the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And it's not like you see on TV, you know, big open bays. That's in basic, you know. When you're actually, you know, in your unit, it's kind of like apartments. Mm. So I was in our apartment. My roommate was awake and on the other side of his area, and there are all these little wall lockers, you know, in between the areas. So it's kind of like little cubicles. And I was trying to go to sleep, and I just started to get more and more relaxed as I was falling asleep. Started to feel real heavy, and I started to feel kind of like this tingling sensation starting at my feet, and it kind of worked its way up to my head. And when it got to my head, it felt like my head was rocking backwards and forwards real fast. It kind of accelerated. Then I just was like, wow, this is weird. And I just went with it. And I had a sensation of kind of like falling asleep, but not losing consciousness, which is a weird thing. And the next thing I know, I'm looking down on myself. Well, I guess I'm looking down on myself. I was looking down on the room. And when all that shaking was going on, my roommate said, what's that noise? And I kind of came out of it a little bit. And what he was talking about is that the microwave was kind of making a popping sound. There was a microwave and a little mini fridge. That mini fridge was rocking a little bit, and the microwave was making this popping, snapping sound. And he got up and he unplugged all that because there was nothing in there. And he went back to his side of the room. And then I started drifting back off again, and it went through that same feeling of my head shaking back and forth. And it started doing it again, and I went, oh, yeah, I know what he's talking about. That's kind of like that poltergeist stuff. you know, what had happened before. Mm-hmm. And then I was looking down on the room. And as I was looking down on the room, a bunch of stuff happened. You know, time was a little bit different. I saw him get up off of his bed and run back over to that microwave and refrigerator. And he paused there for a second, and then he went over to where my body was. And it's weird how everything looked differently. It's difficult to describe, but I describe it in detail in the book. And he shook me out of it. And I was kind of mad, you know. I was like, oh, man, he's shaking me out of it. And the next thing you know, I kind of got, like, imploded back into my body. And when I opened my eyes, I was in sleep paralysis. And he thought I was dying. He thought I was dead. And the next morning, he was he didn't go to sleep, you know. The next morning, he was almost going to whip my ass over that. He was. He was scared. I asked him, I said, what did you see up there in the, up there in that corner? And I pointed up there and he smacked my hand down. And he says, don't you ever talk about this again. I will kill you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an extreme reaction.
Yeah, well, you know, he's kind of Southern Baptist guy from Georgia.
Yeah, he kind of believed in the devil.
He believed in the devil.
He thought it was some kind of occult thing you were doing.
Yeah.
Mm.
And the room had a very different look to it when you're kind of, when you're out of body. It just kind of looked like... Look like that same, like that blue haze. You know, I'm telling you that blue haze?
Yeah.
It looked kind of just like if you're rubbing your eyes, you see a lot of colors. Imagine the room in those colors.
I wonder if he saw a blue haze where you were looking down from.
Well, that's what I tried to ask him, but he refused to answer. And I know him, and he won't talk to me on Facebook.
Well, he applied for a transfer from the room shortly after.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he wanted out of there.
And then you, very shortly afterwards, you almost died.
That's right. It was a matter of weeks later, I got into a motorcycle accident that put me into a coma. I had the whole NDE experience and everything.
And didn't you also appear to your mom?
According to my mom, I don't remember it.
Yeah. His mom said that you
showed
up in after your motorcycle accident, you turned up.
Yeah, evidently she knew about it. She called the United States asking about me. And at the time, I was in the hospital.
Because she was in Brazil at the time.
She was in Brazil at the time.
Yeah.
So they didn't tell her this was what made her aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, what did she say?
I don't know. Again, Jenny could probably answer that because she wrote the book down. She just... I don't remember exactly.
Did she tell you to get back in your body or something?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what she said.
Yeah.
She said you kind of just showed up in her room or something like that.
Well, she said it was the kitchen.
Or the kitchen, yeah. That's right. You showed up in the kitchen and she told you get back in your body right now or something like that.
Yeah, I remember her telling me that.
Which sounds exactly like something.
Sounds like something she'd say.
Yeah.
But you know, I'll be, you know, I'm totally honest about everything that I've been through. I don't remember that happening.
Right.
I'm not saying that didn't happen. It's just that it wasn't the conscious part of me.
Right.
Yeah, she said she saw you.
She said she saw that.
Yeah.
And there's some evidence.
And that's the thing with near-death experiences is that, you know, some people don't have them, or is it that some people don't remember them?
Yeah, I know that from my NDE, I was not... This sounds real corny, you know, but I wasn't allowed to remember everything that I experienced from my NDE. I remember being told that I wouldn't be allowed to remember everything.
Yeah, because you said that they... Whoever you saw when you had told you can't die yet or it's not your time yet. You have all this other stuff you have to do.
I vaguely remember them showing me the future of my life. But mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to remember all of it.
Yeah. Because you couldn't tell me when I asked you.
But, you know, some people say, you know, hey, you know, you had a frontal head injury at that time. You know, your mind can work out a lot, you know, work up a lot of things. But what's weird is that over the years... Some of the vague things that I could remember from that experience did turn out to be true, but they're kind of private. I didn't really include.
Was it did they come to you like a deja vu, like, oh yeah, or did you actually remember enough of them that you recognized them when they happened?
Recognized them when they happened.
Nice.
Yeah.
And what's weird is that, you know, what it looked like was like 360 degrees. It looked like a welding arc. You ever seen those prismatic welding arcs?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looked like. And I don't, from the way I remembered it, some people will say that they'll see a light and they go to it. I don't remember it like that. I was on my motorcycle riding. I look down and I see my shadow casted on the ground of me and my motorcycle riding down the road. And then I start thinking, boy, I had a good life. You know, boy, it was cool to be Tom. And then I realized I'm looking at myself, looking at my shadow. So it was kind of like, what do they call it? I'm looking at my shadow on the ground, and then I'm looking at myself, looking at the shadow on the ground.
It's like Tomception.
Like Tomception. and I said, where are all these shadows coming from? And I look around in the exact opposite position, and there's this big white prismatic light that came down out of the sky, what it seemed like it came out of the sky and got me. Boom, like it grabbed me. And then I was in a place that was just like a prism, like a prismatic welding arc in every direction, just an endless sea of it. And there were these little head and shoulder outlines of people. And I knew them and they knew me, but I can't tell you who they were. I don't know who they were, but we knew each other. And it was just kind of like a head and shoulder outlines, and the communication was kind of telepathic. I could tell who was male and who was female. There was not really speech per se. It's just kind of like telepathy. That's only kind of like the way figures in dreams talk to you. It was like that.
Right.
But it seemed even much more real than dream. It actually seemed more real than reality.
How did the near-death experience change you afterwards?
No fear of death. Hmm. No fear of death. That's the best thing about it.
Yeah, you definitely are not.
Even if that was a hallucination, all right, you still won't have a fear of death.
Did it change like your life path at all?
Hard to tell because I wouldn't know the difference. It just went down the way it was supposed to go.
Well,
maybe.
Would you have re-enlisted in the Army if that hadn't happened or not?
Probably not.
Okay. That wouldn't have made a difference because I was going to say that kept you from re-enlisting because you had a head injury.
When it got right down to it though, I probably would have left anyway.
Yeah.
But I probably would have gone back a couple years later.
Yeah.
Because a lot of guys leave and then take a couple years off and then go back.
Yeah.
I probably would have gone back a couple years later because you end up missing it after a while.
Yeah.
You're like, you know, I kind of belong in the Army. I'm going to go back.
Yeah. But it took you so long to get over the head injury, though. It took a couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just, you know, could barely walk in a straight line for those first 6 months, how dizzy I was.
Yeah.
Mm.
Screws up your equilibrium, you know.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So at the end of the book, you give some speculation on what you think might cause some of this phenomenon.
Yes.
And you talk about the Enfield poltergeist. You also bring up Amityville, which was more than likely a hoax.
Yeah, hoax. Hoax. Yeah.
Also, of course, that was done by, what's their name?
Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Which, you know, early on I had read a book by them and was just like, okay, these two are charlatans. And
yeah,
definitely.
Big time.
Definitely.
That has just been reinforced over and over again over time. I mean, it seems like they probably investigated some genuine cases, but they put such a spin on everything and sensationalized everything that you can't even tell what the original stuff was.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no, you know, pulling apart the truth from it because everything the minute they come in, it's demons.
It's
it
demons.
Doesn't matter what it is.
Yes.
It's gonna be demons.
Yeah.
Well, if you're gonna run around call yourself a demonologist, then everything's a demon.
Exactly. If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
I mean, what, demonology went out in what, 1100 AD?
Yeah.
I do believe John Keel occasionally referred to himself as a demonologist.
It's ridiculous.
But he didn't do that type of stuff. I think with him it was tongue-in-cheek.
Right.
You mentioned the Decker Rain Man, and I wasn't familiar with this at all.
Donnie Decker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd never heard this story.
Donnie Decker's my hero. He was another poltergeist guy. He's in prison right now. When he gets out, I'm going to look him up. He's doing a little bit of time for arson. His boss hired him to cross those insurance wires on the bar that they worked, that he owned, and they got caught. And, you know, can't set fires for insurance money and get away with it. But first time he was in prison, he was making it rain in his prison cell. Hmm. He could hit the warden on the other side of the prison with water when the guards had asked him to do it.
Yeah, he was one of the few people that, I mean, according to witnesses, was able to actually control.
Yeah.
And we kind of researched this case more when we did the Rochdale book, because the most significant factor of the Rochdale case was indoor rain, which is very unusual in poltergeist cases. And that was something that Steve Mara witnessed himself, and he has photos of it and everything.
Donnie Decker was discovered by the police. All right, he was on furlough from prison. He evidently didn't want to go back to prison. He was upset. And the guy he was staying with called the police because it was raining inside the house. The police show up. Not only did they see rain falling from the ceiling, they see it falling up from the floor. Some of the rain would come up off the floor in a big rain droplet and go sideways into other rooms. The police were so shaken that they kept going back there. And it spread like wildfire in the station house. But they couldn't arrest anybody. No crimes were being committed. And that was the beginning of the Donnie Decker case, also known as the Rain Man. And he's a legend among poltergeist agents. A legend.
Now, you have a favorite theory, Tom, of what you think is going on with this.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that just a little bit?
Sure, I guess. Actually, why don't I have Jenny explain it? About the quantum soul theory. And,
well, I think basically
Stuart Hammerall.
What it boils down to is, and you've said this before, you think that the poltergeist phenomena is caused by essentially an out-of-body experience that's only your right brain.
Under the control of your right hemisphere.
Right, yeah.
Which is complicated, but it's documented, though, the right hemisphere.
And as we were saying before, we've kind of been researching the quantum soul theory put forth by Stuart Hameroff, who's an anesthesiologist, and Sir Roger Penrose. And they kind of theorize that maybe there are microtubules in the brain that can interact at a quantum level with, particles outside of your body.
Quantum entanglement.
Yeah.
Quantum field theory.
Right.
Quantum non-local consciousness.
And they're thinking that in some cases, very rare cases, this might actually cause the kind of phenomena that you see in, objects moving, fire starting, that kind of thing.
The quantum processes that happen in your brain are the processes that keep you from being a robot or an automaton. It's the process in your brain that makes you feel like you are there and conscious. Without that, you'd just be a robot. And when you put somebody under anesthesia, sometimes it stops that quantum process and that person becomes an automaton. They can walk, talk, and respond, but they're not conscious. But you need those quantum processes happening. And those quantum processes are a bunch of quantum particles that are entangled with each other, and they can also become entangled with the environment. And once that quantum non-local consciousness becomes entangled at a quantum level with an exterior object, under some certain circumstances, that person can influence that object.
Okay. You also mentioned sleep paralysis earlier. Have you had sleep paralysis throughout your life?
No, not habitually. It was just on that one time, a few minor occasions, but nothing unusual. Everyone's kind of had that at least once.
Right.
But when I came out of that out-of-body experience, my body was in sleep paralysis. I couldn't move. So the brain's doing something during that time.
And Jenny, have you had, aside from the poltergeist experiences with Tom here recently, have you ever had anything weird like this happen to you?
No, that's the thing. And actually, like I said, that's why I'm so glad I finally got to see it, because I'd always kind of wanted to see something like that and never got to. And, a lot of my family, I mean, we grew up and lived in this old house that was my grandfather's, and my mom and all her sisters had grown up there. And they kept telling me that they had seen ghosts in there. They had their covers pulled off. They used to hear footsteps up on the roof. And I lived in that house for years and years, and I never saw anything. And I was so disappointed. I know it probably would have scared the crap out of me, but I still wanted to see it just out of curiosity. I was kind of jealous that they had said that they had seen all these things and I hadn't seen them. So I don't know. Maybe that's why I started writing horror, because I was like, well, I don't see anything in real life, so I just want to make something up because I love that kind of stuff so much, and I was kind of bummed out I never got to see it.
Now, I'd like to clarify something, though. In the case of poltergeist phenomenon, I do not believe that the phenomenon is supernatural.
Right.
I don't believe it's supernatural.
No, not at all.
I believe it's a natural phenomenon.
The term supernatural doesn't really mean much of anything anyway.
No, it's, meaningless.
It's just that we don't understand it, hence it becomes supernatural.
Right. It's paranormal, but it's not supernatural.
Yeah.
It's unusual. But I don't,
It's something we don't understand.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything organically different about the people that can do it. I don't think it has anything to do with the brain or anything to do with anything. I think it mostly has to do with what kind of personality or consciousness you have.
Do you think the location had anything to do with the onset of this? That maybe there was something at Mammoth Mountain that helped set it off?
No, I think it was just the atmosphere of being in a creepy place set it off. Wasn't the place itself.
And I think it was also something to do with you being with Lois, Red, and Wes. Because it seemed like nothing really happened until all of you were together.
It was a group synergy.
Yeah.
It seems like...
I think it fed off the energy that you all had together.
It seemed... The poltergeist cases that I've read, that I've identified as being legitimate, all right, or real, based upon my own personal experiences where things ring true, there seems to be an overarching goal for a poltergeist outbreak, and that's to do one of two things, either to break a family apart or to bind a family together in the face of a common foe. So, in some of the ones that I've studied, it was about a kid trying to get out of a family, all right, by calling help to get authorities and police over to the place. Right. Sometimes it's not. It's to bind a family together to keep it from breaking apart because there's divorces and things like that happen.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
That's what it seems to be looking back on it and looking at the other cases. And what's funny is that there's nothing real... There's nothing real strange about that. There's no higher purpose.
Well, because the strange thing, too, my parents divorced when I was about that age, and I didn't have anything like that happen. Not that I remember, anyway. Obviously, I would remember something like that.
The focus,
you would hope.
focus tends to be emotionally kind of volatile and... in some ways inhibited, but in other ways extroverted. It's like an extroverted kid that has to kind of watch his P's and Q's.
Which that's the way I am. And you were more like that when you were a kid, from what you tell me, because you were in military school.
Yeah.
And...
Yes, I was highly disciplined.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, the book is called The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. And Amazon, you say, is the best place to get it.
Yep.
And you have... what's the second book
called? The other one is called The Rochdale Poltergeist, and I wrote that one with Steve Mara, who he's a parapsychologist. He does the Phenomena Project, a UK TV show, and he's on TV. He investigates all kind of cases.
Yeah, he's a big name.
Yeah. So.
Okay, and you're working on a third one with him as
well. Yeah, this one, it just has a working title at the moment, but yeah, it's about a case in Seattle that he's been investigating. So we're doing Skype interviews with him right now about that. So that'll be out in a couple of months, probably.
Okay, and the website?
Is jennyashford.com or goddessofhellfire.com.
Okay, and as far as your horror fiction, where can people find that?
Same thing, Amazon. And I think all but one of them are print and ebook. So, you know, if you have a Kindle or whatever, you can get them in ebook format, too.
Nice. What kind of inspiration do you have on your horror fiction?
My horror stuff is kind of all over the map. Probably my biggest influences are Clive Barker, Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, maybe a little bit of Stephen King, maybe a little bit of Anne Rice, I guess, as much as I hate to say that. But
how many horror novels do you have out?
Let's see. I have 4 novels and... 2 short story collections, I think. And I have one kind of a graphic novel that's not super horror. It's more like historical crime. But but yeah, they're all on Amazon also.
Nice. Okay. Well, I thank the two of you for this book, which was as I said, I liked it a lot. It was very entertaining to read. It was very interesting and well written. And for sharing your story, Tom, because obviously you've sat on it for quite a while.
Yeah.
Until I came and made you tell everybody about it.
Well, I don't mind. I'm at the age now where I don't care. I'll just tell what happened.
You don't care if people say bad things or Yeah, it's awesome.
All right. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you very much for having us.
So there you go. That was Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross talking about the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. In a month or so, we'll have Jenny Ashford back to talk about her next book. And next week, I'm going to have Greg Bishop on, talking about his new book, It Defies Language. The following week, I have Mike Cleland, finally, to talk about his owl book. The week after that, I have Jeffrey Kripal. That may end up being a two-part interview. We're going to be talking about his new book with Whitley Strieber called The Supernatural, two words. And all of those should be very, very interesting. There'll be midweeks in between, of course. And if you want to help us out by becoming a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. There's a link right on the top. It's only $3 a month. You get some extra content and hopefully some extra stuff as well. And we are working on merchandise still. So when that comes out, you'll get it at a discount. For $3, I think it's probably worth it, I hope. So there you go. All right. To take things out, this is Psyche Corporation with Nightmares.
Shut the closet door. It's under the floor. The monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn. I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform. Cause I'm a monster. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes. En grand spectacle de primavera. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare. Shut the closet door, it's under the floor.